Thanks very much, Mark. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's a privilege to be asked, to be honest. Because when I was drinking, nobody would have asked me to even come to a birthday party, let alone to speak to anybody. When I first came to AA, I didn't understand what a privilege was. I was just totally into myself. People were coming up to me and saying that I was the most important person in the room, which I agreed with, even though, my self-esteem and self-confidence were at rock bottom. I still thought I was very, very important. And I said, "It's great that you're here." And I thought, "You bastards, do you not know how much pain I'm in? Do you not know the daily struggle I go through with drink? Do you not know? Do you not know?" I didn't realize that what they were, they weren't saying that they were glad that I was alcoholic, but they were saying that I was glad that they were glad that I got to AA. Because certainly it's been my experience that I found a solution to my mental dis-ease. And I think that word disease or dis-ease just describes perfectly what I lived through from when I was a young child. I started off, I just didn't do reality very well, and I could never deal with my emotions properly. So I started to retreat into playing with Lego as a kid and reading books and watching films, escaping into another reality where the villain always got punished. Everybody got their just desserts and everything was fair and just. And real life, unfortunately, isn't like that. And I just couldn't deal with it. I remember being at school and we were taking a test or something. It was P6, so I was about maybe 9 or 10 years old. And this guy turned around to ask me a question. I didn't even hear what his question was, but I said, "What?" Because, whatever. And I got caught and sent to the principal's office, and I got punished for just replying to somebody. And I said to my teacher at the time, "But that's not fair. I didn't do anything. That's not fair." And he said, "Well, life's not fair, Timothy." What a dick. Telling a 9 or 10 year old, "Well, life isn't fair." Well, how about fuck you? How about that? And that was kind of my attitude from then on, if not before that. But then I discovered booze when I was about 13 or 14. And that's common, sort of around my area, I suppose, that, between 13 and 16, illicit substances like booze are discovered and you experiment with it. And at the time, we all drank the same. We all drank to get drunk, always just drank to get drunk for the feeling. It certainly wasn't for the taste. Rotten cider on a Friday night, no thank you. I was a blackout and greedy drinker from the very start. And I just thought that was normal because that's the way all me and my mates drank. And yet here I am in a room of AA and none of them are, And that always, it always just sort of, why me? And I used to always think about those superheroes that I loved reading about and, in comic books and films and stuff like that. And I always wanted the tragic backstory, but then to turn out to be the hero, well, I've certainly got a fucking tragic backstory now, so be careful what you wish for. But my parents split up when I was about 11. And dad's just, not to put too fine a point on it, he fucked off. And sort of absolved himself of any responsibility. And I found it very difficult to live at home. What I didn't realize at the time, all I saw was from my own perspective, but my mum was having a very hard time with my stepdad because he was much older and didn't really want to take care of two younger kids. So I resented my mum for all of the things that she had to do. I've since learned very different. But I just find it difficult. I didn't feel comfortable in my own home. It was just a house I stayed in, And then dad moved to Canada when I was about 18, 19, and that was pretty crushing. because he just started a new family, and I just felt very rejected. And I say all of that not for sympathy, but because when it comes to my story, and I can only speak for myself, a lot of the things that happened in my childhood are reasons for the way I developed as an adult. One of those being an addictive personality, you know. And there's an argument as to whether it's nature or nurture. I believe myself that it's sort of half and half because there's alcoholism that does run in the family. But my inability to deal with emotions, you know, the physical compulsion. Certainly, I think that's a genetic thing, but when it comes to the mental obsession, that to me is all nurture. But you know, drinking wasn't a problem for me for quite a while. I coasted through school. I was very, very good at maths and things which were logical, and I did have an artistic side as well. Got to university, fucking hated it because I was too interested in drinking. So I went back to our local sort of technical college, studied media studies, which is a bit more airy fairy, and then went back to university to study visual communication. And that was great, you know. All the while, you know, drink was involved, but it never overpowered anything in my life. And I got a girlfriend, and we got engaged, and we got a house, and I was working full time and in full time education to pay for the house. And coming towards the end of my degree, I realized I'm not happy. I'm not happy at all. Society says that I'm meant to now get a job, get married, and have kids, and I don't want to be married, and I don't want kids. I don't want to be tied down to the house. And I think at the time it was probably just because I was a very, very selfish person. I didn't want to be beholden to anybody. You know, I didn't want anything to hold me back. I didn't want to be told what to do and when to do it, which is the way I saw the relationship. So I split up with my fiance and got a job on cruise ships, and it was freaking open season. So being, I mean, over working for a company called Holland America in the Caribbean, working for an American company, people from North America don't tend to see north and south of Ireland. They just see Irish, and that means that you're a drinker. And I happily obliged, you know, 80 cents for a bottle of beer. Are you kidding me? Brilliant. Fill your boots. And I was drunk every single night. From then on, until I was about 37, to be honest. Still, though, it didn't really cause a problem, but it did start to leak in the and this is a sort of, for me, the insidious nature of alcoholism. It crept in ways which I didn't notice at first. Like, I'd always be wondering, you know, if we had a bit of time off and we're heading to the beach, was there a bar nearby? You know, was I, you know, I always wanted to be near alcohol. And it wasn't necessarily all the time to get blocked, but it certainly was to ease the day, you know, ease the cogs. And then I think about 3.5 years after working on cruise ships, I was working on the QE2 and got myself so. I blamed it on one of the passengers, actually, because I could never take responsibility for my actions. But I got so frigging drunk, I fell down a flight of, I think it was 30 something stairs, and split my chin open. And that was a big no-no. You weren't allowed to be drunk, or at least seen to be drunk on the ships. And I was completely battered with blood pissing out of my chin. I tried to fight off the medical staff because all I wanted to do was go home. I had to be sedated. I was told about all of this afterwards. But needless to say, I was sacked and not allowed to work on any of the Cunard ships ever again, banned for life, which I saw at the time as an achievement. You know, and that's a bit sad, really. It's not an achievement at all, but I went on to work on another company on board, but the drink That was the first instance that I can pinpoint where the drink started to come into life and stopped me from being a complete human being. I came back from ships and fell into another job, ended up managing a couple of restaurants. But again, I was making sure that I was close to alcohol, working and managing these restaurants. So you worked hard. That meant you were allowed to party hard. I was enabling myself. And it's part of the culture and working in hospitality that there's a lot of booze involved, and it was great fun and everything. And except I wasn't having fun unless I was drinking. I wasn't getting any fun or contentment or fulfillment out of life as a whole. And the thing is, I knew I was better than what I was doing, or sorry, I knew I was more capable of what I was doing, and therefore I was resentful of anything and everything. And yet it still wasn't my fault. It still wasn't the drink's fault either. I could not accept responsibility for my actions, and I couldn't accept that drink had become a toxic influence in my life. And I went through other jobs as well, and the drinking got worse and worse, to the point where so my dad came. I should mention actually, I stayed with my gran on and off when I worked on cruise ships because I didn't want to stay with mum. She was just too severe, and I didn't like my stepdad, so I stayed with my gran. And it's important to mention her because she was one of the most stable influences in my life, and the first woman in my life to ever actually show me unconditional love. I've since realized, through listening to my mum talk about her upbringing, that she didn't know how to either. So I have certainly resolved any blame that I put in my mother for an unhappy childhood. But I didn't know any of that at the time. But my gran was the first person to show me unconditional love, no matter what state I was in. And she so I stayed with her on and off on cruise ships, but then later on she took chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And when she went through chemotherapy, I would stay with her to make sure, allegedly, that she got down the stairs okay, because obviously after the chemo it can make leave you very shaky. And this is a lady well into her 80s, who was just a force of nature. I was meant to be looking after her. And I would roll out of bed at 11 o'clock in the morning, and come downstairs with bleary eyes, and she's cooking breakfast and ironing my underpants. Now, who was taking care of who? She's just an amazing, amazing lady. But the reason I was staying with her was not out of love, because I didn't. I was too immature to know really what love was. I was staying with her because I wanted people to think I was a great guy, And I've resolved that in my head since then. That among many other things. But it was her death who actually that actually brought about my introduction to AA inadvertently, because my dad and my stepmom came over from Canada. And I'd always had sort of a passing relationship with my dad. But my stepmom was a great talker, and she knew how to talk about feelings. And she's a great woman who I'm very close to today. But she hadn't seen me. Dad had seen me in the past sort of last 2 years or so, but Anne, my stepmom, hadn't seen me in about 7 or 8 years. And she took one look at me and, unbeknownst to me, burst out crying, because my eyes weren't white anymore. They were yellow. I'd physically changed. I had the drawn look of a good proper alky. Not eating right and sunken cheeks and all of that. And after the funeral, my dad sat me down, and I thought we were going to talk about my gran's will. And he asked me a very, very important question, and I don't know if he is just naturally gifted at knowing the right thing to say, or if he got advice on the right thing to say to an alcoholic. He's probably just one of those bastards that does life well naturally. But he said to me, "Tim, do you think you have a problem with drink?" He didn't say, "I think you have a problem with drink." He asked me, "Do you think you have a problem with drink?" And that was the first time I had been confronted in that way with at least a little compassion. And yet still I couldn't admit it. I said, I don't know. So he gave me a couple of phone numbers for traditional AA. And I phoned him, and I was expecting a sympathetic voice on the end of the line. And this guy came on. I said, hello, is that AA? And he goes, yes, this is AA. And I said, yeah, I'm struggling a wee bit here. And he goes, right, you got a problem with drink? No bother. As if I had just said, I need a new pair of socks. You know, it was second nature to him. I was expecting, you know, somebody to make a big deal out of it. And he's like, yeah, dead on. Okay. You just stay in the line. I'll get you somebody to phone you in 5 minutes. And sure enough, within a couple of minutes, a guy phoned me. And we met up. We actually met up outside a coffee shop. And he took one look at me and said, right, come on to my house. Because he knew I was in a rough state. And I thought, here we go. Another fucking lecture. Brilliant. I've been here before. Yeah. I have 2 hours of being told what a piece of shit I am again. Yeah. Bring it on. But to my surprise, he didn't ask me any questions at the start, and he didn't ask about me at all. He talked about himself, and he talked about his struggles with drink and how he enjoyed it at the start, and how gradually, slowly but surely, it took over his life until he was left with nearly nothing. And then at the end of it, he said, so does any of that make any sense to you? And I said, fucking all of it, mate. So he took me to my first meeting. And I didn't even see anything that was on the walls at the time. They asked me if I wanted to share. And everybody else had stood up and or spoken up and said, my name's whoever and I'm an alcoholic. And I think that was the first time I was honest in decades. And I said, my name's Tim, and I don't know if I'm an alcoholic because I have no fucking clue what's going on. And yeah, it was the first time I was honest, and I don't know how long. But gradually, you know, the fog cleared physically, and I started to actually smile. And I started to notice things on the walls, like all those wee trite sayings you get in AA. You know, let go, let God, and all of that stuff, which, no, fuck off. You know, I was brought up to be agnostic in essence. I was given my own choice when I was brought up, and I had a brain in my head, so I just didn't see any use to religion whatsoever. I saw, certainly in Northern Ireland, I saw what it could do on the negative side of things and split people apart and kill people, maim, murder. The things that are done in the name of religion, in my mind, are unforgivable. But you know, I stuck with it, and I agreed at the time with fake it till you make it. Yeah, I'll just pretend, you know, I'll pretend to do, you know, to go along with the prayers, and never got down on my knees because fuck no, I don't care how sick, dead, or dying I am. I will bow to no man, especially not an imaginary beard in the sky. Get down on your knees and pray. Fuck off. I'm sorry. I feel a little less passionately about it right now. You know, I understand why people do it, but it's not for me. But you know, I went along with it, and things got better. And I would love to say I didn't drink again, but boy, I did. And I drank a lot again because one of my biggest problems in life was seeking externally for something to fix me because I saw myself as broken, bad, black on the inside. So I looked externally for validation, for someone to tell me it's all right, you're a good person. And there were plenty of people in AA doing that, but I still didn't get it, you know. I couldn't, you know, because everybody in AA was telling me just get a higher power, you know, and that doesn't fit with my belief system at all. To me, my recovery depends on me doing the work. I am responsible for my actions today I have been responsible for all of my actions, and I stand up and I'm counted for them. And that's an important part of my recovery. So if I hand that over and say it's part of God's ineffable plan, then I'm not responsible for my actions. A big beard in the sky is. So how the hell does that work? You know, that doesn't fit in with my sensibilities. I'm responsible for my actions, good and bad, and that means I'm responsible for my recovery. I can't hand it over. I can't let somebody else take care of it. Because that's what I always did. I was really the why I drank, you know. So I did drink again. I managed to get an amazing job over in Africa teaching photography and, you know, working 16-hour days and going out into the bush and taking photographs of lions and elephants and hyenas and things. And it was absolutely amazing. And I lasted for about 2.5 years out there without taking a drink and without really any program to speak of until it crept in, you know. And it crept in with one beer one day, and then the next week it was one beer one day, and within 3 months it was a bottle of brandy a day at least, you know. And that's why I know this disease is progressive for me. And I've seen it in other people as well. But I didn't have a program, and I didn't have the support over there that I have over here. You know, I could get to one meeting a week, and again, it was very faith-based. People would say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting, which, you know, I always preferred the Guinness Prayer. You know, our beer, which art in barrels, hallowed be thy drink. Thy will be drunk. I will be drunk at home as it is in the pub, you know, and give us this day our creamy head and forgive us our spillages. All that. But yeah, I drank again over in Africa. And it got to the point where I had to make a terrible decision. Either stay here and risk myself, or go back home to where I knew that I would get the help that I needed. And as soon as I made that decision, and it's very rare for me that both my head and my heart agree on anything, but I knew it was the right decision to make, and I felt so relieved, you know. So I came back home, and I still couldn't deal with it. The low self-esteem and the lack of self-confidence. Yeah, it crushed me because I saw it as a failure. Where it wasn't a failure, you know, I learned how to teach. I learned how to, you know, all of these things about the animals and learning about wildlife photography and everything and everything, but I couldn't see it. What I had done was I'd swapped my obsession for drink with an obsession for work. So I came back, and I started the work again and went through the program again. And on and off, I got periods of sobriety between 6 months and a year. And when it was good, but when it was bad, it was fucking awful. You know, the last drink I took, and again, this is the progressive nature of the disease. You know, I didn't go out and have a wee beer. I went out and bought a big bottle of vodka. You know, I had half an hour of feeling maybe numb, and then for the next 10 days, I was drinking warm raw vodka straight from the bottle, because I couldn't cope with the guilt, shame, and remorse that I was drinking again. You know, and that's the madness of this disease. People say they drink and then they go mad. I go mad and then I drink, because surely to drink is madness. I know it is. Thank God it's different today. You know, I look back on on the way I was thinking and just shiver internally. You know, I would disagree with a lot of the language within AA because it's quite archaic and out of date, to be honest. But there's one thing in that big book which I really identify with, and that's the savage state of mind. You know, that horrific kind of just all churning state of mind. There's a series called Elementary with Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu, And he's supposed to be a sort of modern day Sherlock, and he's recovering from heroin addiction, and that's quite a big part of oh, well, certainly of his personality. But he's at a meeting, and he describes his addiction as having a finely tuned Formula One Ferrari engine inside his head, and it's running absolutely full tilt, but nothing's connected. And I can identify with that too. I think, there's a commonality amongst all addictions. You're trying to fill that hole inside. And there's certainly behavioral similarities between all addictions as well. I mean, the problem with addiction, I believe, for me, is the substance itself, whatever you use to deal with reality as such, that's a symptom of the disease you suffer from, the dis-ease, the disconnection. And I find that, and I still find today, that the antidote for me is communication with other people. Because isolation, that was the way I sort of shut the world out, lock the door. I would look, actually, in the midst of it all, I would lock the door, the front door, take my three bottles of wine or bottle of vodka upstairs, sit on the toilet in the bathroom, and lock that door too. Because I knew subconsciously I was doing something wrong, so I had to hide and make sure that nobody ever caught me. But the funny thing is, I nobody would ever find any drink of mine, ever. I was a genius at hiding it. But see, when there wasn't any drink left in the bottle, they would always find the empties. Because fuck, why would I give a shit about an empty bottle? But they would never find any drink. But that's again, that's the nature of the disease for me. But it's my nature, which I've had to look at carefully from both sides of the coin, and I think from my, again, the low self-esteem and all of that, I concentrated on the bad aspects of my personality. That's what needs fixed. That's what needs to change. And it's not just about that. I need to be more compassionate with myself, and learn to love myself and see myself as a flawed human being. But there's perfection in that, it's life isn't meant to be absolutely perfect and rosy and fucking unicorn farts and strawberries all the time, Life's a bit of a bollock sometimes, but when you can actually, or what I find, when I can actually go with the flow with life and stop headbutting my way through life, it just goes a lot easier, Today, I had a great day today. I faffed about all weekend. I've got this wee sort of notice board where I write my schedule. I work for myself now as a handyman and photographer, which is a great combination, a great variety. But I write my schedule up here, and I'd written for the weekend that I wanted to reseal my own bath. And I'd, the way when you look at something and you don't want to see something, so you just see something else. And I saw it this morning, reseal the bathroom. I was, fuck's sake, I meant to do that all weekend. And all I did was play computer games and go to meetings and stuff. So I did it this morning. And despite myself, I had a good day. I often get days like that, because I've left myself out of the equation, I've had a good day. Because I haven't spent the whole day involved in myself, I've had a good day. I take a great joy today in doing things for other people. I take a great joy in photography because concentrating on that subject that I'm photographing, it stops me thinking about myself. I have a great relationship with my mother today. I found out, and here's a shocker, my mum's actually a human being. It's weird that I saw her as this powerful, She was like, people say, I had the fear of God put into me when I was younger. I had fear of mum, She was a physiotherapist, and when she slapped you, I swear to God, you woke up and your clothes were out of fashion. But today, my mum and I have a brilliant relationship. We can be honest with each other, and open. For the most part, there's some things a mother doesn't need to know. But again, that's a key component of my recovery today is being honest with myself. And that's why I struggled early on with the recovery program, because I couldn't hand it over to God, you know. I couldn't sit and recite the Lord's Prayer at a meeting because I wasn't being honest, you know. Today, you know, I do service in the secular meeting for Bangor, like Mark was saying there. And I feel such a freedom within the secular rooms of AA because I'm not lying to anybody. And I'm not having to watch what I say so as not to offend somebody who is religious. Not that I would intentionally do that, but when somebody's preaching at me and telling me you need a higher power, you know, the best way to tell me to do something is to tell me not to do it. You know, I'm a stubborn, arrogant son of a bitch when I want to be. You know, and if somebody says to me, you need to get a higher power, well, you need to fuck off. That's what you need to do. If somebody told me, Tim, you need to breathe, I would hold my breath. You know, so today, because I have resolved that sort of that higher power issue, you know, I thought I wasn't getting it because, well, you know, because I didn't have a higher power, because I was a bad person, because I didn't believe in religion. That's a load of bollocks. The recovery program is the bare bones for me. And I'm the one that puts the flesh and sinew and skin and hair and teeth and fingernails and eyeballs and all that crap on it. You know, the recovery program works with or without religion. Whoever, if religion's your thing, fill your boots. You know, I'm not going to tell you what to think. Don't you tell me what to think either, you know. And I'll finish with the quote. Mark said that we were talking about Maggie Smith in that conversation, and it's a lovely quote, and it suits me down to the ground because it suits my nature, and it suits my opinion about why I far prefer secular AA to regular traditional AA. And she says, religion is like a penis. It's okay to have it, and it's even okay to be proud of it. But when you take it out and wave it in somebody's face, they tend to get offended. You know, and that's it just sits me down to the ground. You know, I don't like to be told what to think. Just leave me to it, you know. Certainly, if you want to give me advice, the best way to do that is to wait until I ask for it, you know. And I try to practice the same thing. I get it wrong all the time. I get it wrong all the time. But because I have a support group, like a bunch of lunatics just like me, you know, I can come on and rant and rave all the time. And there's many people in the world who don't have who have problems, but don't necessarily have a forum like this to voice them in, to get advice when they ask for it, and to just be heard. You know, I find myself and see myself as very fortunate today. I do a lot of work every day on my recovery, but it's because I'm a selfish bastard at heart. I like being happy. You know, I've discovered I like being happy. I like being contented, and that's why I keep coming back to the meetings. And that's when Mark said to me, would you do a chair? It is a privilege to come and speak to anybody that will listen, especially when it's my favorite topic, which is me. So thank you very much again, Mark. I leave it there. Thanks, buddy.